tonight on Arena. Photographer Steve Pike on his new project. We preview the new Netflix Victoria Beckham documentary and Irish writers in The New Yorker. You can text us on 51551. Arena at rte.ie is our email. You'll find us on Instagram at rte_arena. Now, as autumn nights draw in, curling up with a good book takes some beating, but set to give us plenty of excuses to leave the house, the Dublin Book Festival takes place early next month. To whet the appetite before it begins, there'll be a few teaser events, and tomorrow evening, internationally acclaimed photographer Steve Pike will be in conversation as his new book and exhibition are launched. Scribendi, Portraits of Irish Writers, 1985 to 2025, features more than 100 portraits of Ireland's leading contemporary writers, as well as their personal reflections. And Steve Pike joins me this evening. Welcome to Arena, Steve.
It's nice of you to have me.
You've undertaken a year-long residency at the Photo Museum Ireland, and that was completing this book in the process. The portraits, though, they span the last 40 years, but this sort of life, it wasn't the plan for you at all growing up, was it?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. But literature has always been a huge thing for me. Books were, like, as a child, were a form of escape. And I was born in the Midlands, in Leicester, in a working class family. And in lots of ways, I kind of felt, I think when I was growing up, that my life was kind of worked out for me when I was a child. And there were a number of things that happened that meant that I was, you know, able to get away from that. One of which was punk, because I'm of that generation where that was, you know, it was hugely influential to me. It gave me a sense that really you could do anything. When before that I'd been told that I was supposed to work in a factory.
How did punk music change your life then at that point? What happened?
Well, I heard Anarchy in the UK, so I heard John singing that, And I first saw some of that when I was in America, in New York. I'd visited there in 1976, bicentennial year. And when we came back, it was really raging. I went on the White Riot tour with The Clash. I followed them. And in fact, I became a close friend of Joe's. And punk music, the thing that with it, it was like a philosophy in a way, in as much as you realize that you didn't need to obey the rules that in lots of ways that were given to you before, that you could. It was kind of like a revolution in a way, and a lot of the people that I know now that came through that period with me are still creatives, and they're still working and putting things together. And there's no way, if I hadn't had that experience, that I'd be sitting here now, that what happened in my life would have, you know, there was much more chance that I would have stayed in Leicester. And I mean, who knows what would have happened there.
How did you discover photography then in the first place for you?
Well, I was in bands. I was a singer in bands, and I did that for a couple of years. And I came across to Dublin in the winter of 79 in My mother and father-in-law lived here in Sandymount, and they took us down to Funderland, to the RTE, and I started to photograph these points of chaos, like, you know, like the fairground is and nightclubs are. And I photographed, I remember photographing the Wall of Death here. They had it. And those pictures are actually in the book, I Could Read the Sky. There's a sequence from the first roll of film that I shot this in, I Could Read the Sky. So I found photography completely by accident. But as soon as I developed that first roll of film, it was like alchemy. It was like this magic happened, you know? And when I saw those negatives, held them up to the light, and I saw those negatives, I knew it was like a turning point. What I really was interested in was portraiture and meeting people. And that's where I really picked up and started to photograph my generation, the people that had experienced that movement, the punk movement. And I photographed sculptors and writers, filmmakers. And that was the beginnings of my first portfolio, which I took to The Face and The Enemy, and I was commissioned. So I came to it not through an education, but through like an education of life in a way.
How do you get access to people like that early on when you're just starting your career? Did you just rock up to people and say, hi, I'm Steve, I'd like to take your photo?
Well, I've been in bands, so I knew a bunch of them. And I knew, you know, I knew like Joe, and I knew people, you know, I knew people that were in different bands. And Susie, I was able to photograph them and photograph them at home in situations. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing with the camera. I didn't know anything about f-stops or numbers or anything like that. In fact, lots of ways I still don't, because any technical side of things, it really doesn't interest me. What's interesting to me is what's going on now, you know, conversation. And essentially that's what I do. I record conversations I have with people. I don't, you know, I think that the people that I photographed early on, there's not that much difference in the way that I photograph now. And I photographed them in their domestic setting, which is really how I photographed most of these portraits of Irish writers. I always, if I can, would insist on photographing people at home. Because there's always something at home that it settles people, that people are more at home, but there's something about people, of course, in their home environment, and that's what I tried to photograph in this book.
Do you still use analog film?
So I shoot with the same camera that I started with, which is a Rolleiflex. It's a 2.8 Rolleiflex. Having said, I'm not interested in the technical side of things, I'll explain it. It's like one of these box cameras you used to see people on the seafront taking pictures, you know, with a parrot on their shoulder. Yeah, yeah. And they'd say, you know, can I take a picture of you and your girlfriend, your husband or whatever? And so I photograph with this camera, and it shoots film. It shoots 120 film, which you can still get. I get it from a store in New York. I live in America. And I get it ordered. I order it there, and you can still get film. And all of these pictures that are in this book are shot analog. So I photograph with a camera which enables me to get quite close as well. So a lot of people know my work as being close portraiture, close black and white portraiture. And with Scribendi, I wanted to get away from that in some ways. There are close black and white portraits in it, but there's also close colour portraits. And there are colour portraits that are shot on what I call dead stock, which is old, very, very, very old 35mm stock. So I was collecting old rolls of film, some of it 20, 25 years old, and I was shooting that. And part of the reason for me doing that was I knew with the black and white film that I had something. I only shoot one roll of film, which is 12 frames, and then I shoot 6 frames of colour. And the colour was shot on this, what I call dead stock. It's just something I made up myself, a title. I actually like the title. And the film is extremely volatile, and you don't really know what you're going to get out. But I delight in all that, because it's like when you first used to get pictures back from Boots, you know, and the pictures would come back in and you didn't know what you were going to get. And I had to make them, balance them on the computer, and I made the pictures from those. And there's a lot of those photographs from the old stock which are in this book.
When it comes to taking photographs of people, those people for the book, for instance, how do you describe what happens between you and that person when you're in the process of taking that photograph?
Okay, so it's kind of like what's going on here, Rick. Like we're having a conversation and we're a bit closer, but we're about 6 feet away. Mm. Usually I'm a bit closer in an area that a lot of the time kind of only loved ones get into. So I'm very close, I work close, and the conversation goes, and the camera is introduced at a certain point. But usually what I ask for is like an hour with somebody. And often I'll be talking and they'll be talking. We'll have a conversation that lasts like 45 minutes. And then I kind of bumble about with my camera and put it on a tripod. So I use natural light, shoot with the tripod. So they're usually shooting like slow exposures. And I photograph the 12 frames. But it really, I think that my portraits are kind of extensions of those conversations. And they are, you know, this to some extent, somebody's got to know something about me in that 45 minutes. And the portrait, in some way, hopefully, reflects something of what goes on between me and that person.
Is there that possibility of capturing, I don't want to get all spiritual on it, but the idea of the essence of somebody, or maybe some sort of unguarded moment that's happened between the two of you?
I think that there's a lot of things that you see in those 45 minutes where you think, I would have got that. I can try and recreate that. But I'm not, my photography is about, I'm much more interested in the spontaneity of it. And I think what's really important as well in any photograph is gesture. Because gesture will give you another sense of somebody, the way that somebody makes a gesture, even if it's in, the gesture's in the face, in a facial movement, but usually with their hands. So I like gesture in pictures. And there's also something that's, I really like the element of risk, because I think that nowadays the world is so risk averse, and risk is a really, really important thing in your life, you know, to take risk. And maybe as you get older, you take less risk. You're more careful about it. But I think that risk is really important. Now, I could say that, you know, the dead stock that I use was the thing that I was shooting for risk, you know. And to a lot of extent it is, because I could have ended up with nothing.
Tell me about some of the people who are in the book, because you've obviously taken some of these photos relatively recently of quite new Irish authors, but there are a lot of photos that go much, much, much further back. There's this, Edna O'Brien is in there. Iris Murdoch is in this book.
Yeah. So Iris was photographed for philosophers. So I did a series of portraits of analytical philosophers, and I photographed Iris in 1990 in Oxford. So that was a portrait. That portrait itself was actually the colour portrait that's in Scribendi was a lost portrait. It was a little Kodachrome slide that was at the bottom of the neck bag, and I'd never seen it really since the day. So it's nice to be able to put something in like that that's like, you know, discovered. And Edna was photographed for, Edna O'Brien was photographed for a literary magazine, and a Japanese literary magazine called Switch, which existed in the early 90s. And they got me to come here to Ireland and photograph their five portraits, which are all in the book. So John Banville, John McGann, I photographed Edna O'Brien, and I think Seamus Dean was in that as well. And Timothy O'Grady. That's the first time I met Timothy O'Grady. And we later went on to make I Could Read the Sky together. And Neil Jordan, they used a picture of mine of Neil Jordan, which was the first, actually, picture of Neil was the first portrait, was the earliest portrait that's in this book. And that was photographed for The Face, this old magazine that used to exist back in the day. In fact, I think it still does exist in a different form. Yeah. But it was one of the first magazines that I worked for.
Is it right that with the newer writers in it, you went through a process where, certainly for some of them anyway, you took their photos and then said to them, suggest a list of other people that might be really good for this? And it was almost like it moved from person to person to person.
Well, I'll go back a little. When I photographed the philosophers, I'm not an analyst. I'm not an analytical philosopher. I'm not an academic. So I couldn't choose my philosophers. So what I did with the philosophers, I asked them all, give me 10 names of people that you think should be in my book. And when a name came up three times, I went to that person. It's just logical. Mm-hmm. So I did that. Of course, with this book, I had people that I definitely wanted to photograph. And, you know, Sinead Gleeson, I wanted to photograph. And Wendy Erskine, Donald Ryan, lots of people that I definitely wanted to include. But I still asked everybody who do you think I should photograph? And so people came up. It's really important that there was that participation as well. And I put them all down in this book here. So this book contains the names of 70 writers with their list of 10 people that they felt that I should photograph.
It's actually a really looking book.
Yeah, it's a really interesting lists are really interesting. I'm fascinated by lists. You know, I collect them. And like in the bottom of shopping carts, I pick them up all the time. I've got a drawer full of them.
I'm going to scroll back just for a second. You worked for The New Yorker for quite some time, didn't you? What was that like?
Working for The New Yorker is like there's nowhere really else that you work in the same way. You get a lot of time for a portrait. So ordinarily I get sort of 3 days. So if it was someone like just a name, Don DeLillo, I photograph Don, and they give me a day. And I mean, you can't read Underworld in a day, I know. And I read it anyway, but which is an amazing book. But they give you a day to do research, and then you'd have a day where you went into meetings and they taught you about what it was, what do you have in mind for this picture? And there's an amazing bunch of researchers at the New Yorker. And then I work with the great Elizabeth Biondi, who's the best visuals editor I've ever worked for. And she's very understanding. She's worked for the best photographers, really. I mean, amazing photographers. So the New Yorker is like nowhere else, really, to photograph. And you have many options and people give you a lot of time. And not only does your own name go ahead of you and they know what you photographed, the no pictures that I've shot, but the name of the magazine does as well. You know, the New Yorker's like, pretty like no other, you know. I photographed a lot of really interesting people for that.
Budget was presumably no problem with that.
Yeah, there's not, no, but I was on staff. That's the way that they, I used to work on as a freelance for them before, and I actually earned more money as a freelance, but I was on staff for 15 years, 12 years with them. And before that I was working out of a studio in London, and I'd photograph in Europe. So I'd come to Dublin, go to Paris or Rome, because their staff photographer, they only had one at the time, Richard Avedon, he didn't often come to Europe. So, you know, he photographed everything in New York and I photographed these pictures. So when he passed, that's when I got that gig.
I know it's almost an impossible question given the nature of your career, but have you had a favourite person that you've photographed over the years?
Well, not a favourite, but favourite collections of pictures. And, you know, the New Yorker, there were a lot of really amazing pictures and people that you can photograph. I photographed, before I was on staff, I photographed a portrait of Augusto Pinochet. And it was kind of the last picture of him before he was arrested. And they told me that I was going to be photographing, this is what they described it as, an ex-major world dictator. This is what one of the researchers told me.
That narrows the
and
list.
I had to guess who it was. And I thought, well, Idi Amin was living in Paris at the time. But I didn't know that Pinochet was coming through London to meet, it would have been Thatcher maybe still. And And so then about an hour before, so I had to set up for a shoot. So this is what happens with the New Yorker shoot. I had to think of a place, and they said he's difficult. So I had to think of a situation that I had in for 40 minutes and that I would be able to have different rooms that I could show him into in case he dissed the first room that I went to. So I had to have a series of different situations set up. So the top floor of the Dorchester is where Eisenhower commanded I'd photographed there before, and that's where he commanded the operations during the Second World War. And I went there and I set all the five suites up with lights. But the picture that worked is when he first came in, and I thought, I don't want to shake this guy's hand. You know, he's a mass murderer. But he came up and he put his hand right out to me, and there's nothing else you can do. He's like, somebody offers their hand. So I shook it and I pointed him to this table, low table with these glasses, and I photographed him with this natural light, and that was the first picture. And behind him, I didn't even realize properly, was this kind of inferno of red velvet drape, and I hadn't seen it. But when it came out, it was like he was sort of stepping out of hell, you know. It was just because everything, the mistakes that you make often in life, I think, and in work, are often the best things that you can make, the things that you don't see.
Steve Pike, it's been brilliant to talk to you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us on Arena. Steve's new book, Scribendi, Portraits of Irish Writers, 1985 to 2025. It's published by the Lilliput Press and as part of the lead-in to the Dublin Book Festival, which opens in early November. Steve will be in conversation with Anthony Farrell from Lilliput and author Timothy O'Grady tomorrow evening at Photo Museum Ireland at Meeting House Square in Temple Bar in Dublin. I think all the tickets are sold out. I think it's waitlist only as far as I know, but you can register for the waitlist at dublinbookfestival.com.
Thank you.
never something completely different. Tomorrow, Netflix launches a new docuseries, Victoria Beckham, which gives an intimate portrait of the former Spice Girl charting her evolution from pop star to fashion powerhouse. Directed by Nadia Hallgren, the series traces her life as a pop icon, her marriage to David Beckham, and the battles she endured to build her haute couture label. The series culminates in the intense behind-the-scenes preparations for her Paris Fashion Week show. Joining me tonight to review the series is Don O'Neill, himself an acclaimed Irish fashion designer who's worked with Christian Lacroix and Carmen Mark Volvo and was the creative director of Thea, where he dressed stars like Oprah Winfrey, Nicole Kidman and somebody called Taylor Swift. Don, welcome to Arena tonight. You're a designer that's worked with some of the biggest names in the biz, but being honest, how did you and your peers react when you first heard that Victoria Beckham was starting her own couture label?
Well, hello, Rick, and greetings from Ballyhyg. It's lovely to be on the air with you this evening, and it's lovely to be discussing the very talented Victoria Beckham. So, to be frank and to be honest, when Victoria first came out of her collection, which was in 2008, a lot of us were very sceptical. Sceptical because obviously she didn't have a design background, and at the time, there were a lot of celebrities out there with their own lines putting labels on clothes that were designed by other people. So it was basically a wait and see. And as viewers will see in the program tomorrow night, Victoria's first collection took people by surprise. They were not expecting her to do what she did. And fair play to her, she knocked it out of the park with her very first Victoria Beckham collection.
Before all of that happens, do we learn why Victoria wanted to be a designer? Where did that push come from?
So I think there's a multi-pronged approach to this, but Victoria delves back into her youth, basically, and her desire to be a performer and to be in theatre, and sort of being that unsightly girl at school that was sort of pushed to the back row of the chorus line. And she was a bit unpopular, not through any fault of her own. She was bullied quite a bit. So Victoria came with a lot of baggage. And I think Victoria had a very deep-seated need to be seen as somebody else when she was very young. And I think through the Spice Girls and how she developed into the young adult that she became and her fascination with fashion, she saw the power of clothing and how it can transform people and how people can be seen differently by just how they dress themselves and how they wear. And that was the seed, a very little seed that was like Jack and the Beanstalk. It became this giant beanstalk because she had that passion to transform herself through the power of fashion, and she was determined to make that happen, and she did.
Okay, I want to take a piece from the documentary itself. This is Victoria Beckham talking about her love of fashion and how her former life as a pop star went against her in the industry.
I'm sure the fashion industry liked listening to the Spice Girls at some point, maybe, maybe not, but I don't think that they saw me as cool at all. And I get it. I understand why there's been those preconceptions, but I never took no for an answer.
That is too high.
This has not been an easy ride. I mean, I'm lucky I've still got a business, and I'm not gonna let it slip through my fingers again. But I do feel the pressure of that, and that's because I am still judged on every single level because of where I've come from.
Don, take us back to the beginning, and by that I mean her first foray into fashion, the designing jeans part.
So I think that was an easy beginning for her. She designed jeans for a company called Rock and Republic, which was very successful. And then she followed that with her own range based on that success called VB Rocks. That was called VB Rocks. And then she had her own line called DVB Style. And basically, they were hugely successful for her. So she got a taste for success in fashion, but that really wasn't what she was about. She really wanted to step into the real world of fashion. And at the time, Victoria was a very chic woman. She was very, very conscious of how she dressed. There's a story, an anecdote that you'll see in the film, when as Posh Spice, she was flown to see the Versace show, and there was a private jet and was hugely exciting. And she was taken to the Versace store where she was asked, Donatella took her to the store, pick anything you want and you can wear it to the show. And she was hugely excited, found this leather dress that she fell in love with, kind of. And she thought, oh, this would be cooler if it didn't have sleeves. And it would be way cooler if it was shorter. And how cool would it be if it was skin tight? She literally redesigned the dress and had it remade to the shock horror of Donatella. But Victoria at the time I think, was terribly naive or just terribly, terribly opinionated on what she should look like. And that's what she wore to the front row of the show. So it's what, it kind of sets her up at the very beginning of how determined she was, how she was perceived, what her style was, and who she wanted to be seen as. Even in front of Donatella Versace, she wanted to create her own style, which Donatella admits she was shocked, but she kind of appreciated the girl for being honest.
That determination presumably gets you some of the way, but there's an enormous step up between designing your own jeans and then launching your own label. It's what, 2008 when that happens? Does she have mentors? Does she have people that she's calling on, people who are helping her in the process?
She was really fortunate in the beginning. There was a designer that she wore a lot of in the early 2000s, and it was Roland Moray. And he had this amazing dress called the Galaxy Dress, and everybody was wearing this form-fitting dress that just transformed your body with this built-in corset inside it. And Victoria wore Roland Moray really well, and they became good friends. And when she wanted to start her own line, she knew she needed help, and she reached out to Roland, who was incredibly generous, and he mentored her through her first several collections, and he really brought it down to brass tacks and explained it to her how difficult and hard this industry was. She couldn't sketch, but basically he taught her how to use fabric and drape with fabric, which she explains in the show, to create the style she wanted. So she was basically taught by him, but dressing herself in the styles that she felt she couldn't find in the market to be the woman that she, the Victoria Beckham woman, or the Victoria Beckham brand, as it would become.
Yeah, when it comes to the way she actually designs, that's kind of an interesting one. Do we see her at work on the collection in the series?
Not really. And you know what? I was a little bit disappointed, because I would really love to see her, the method, how she creates. And you see her in the studio. She's working with an incredible design team, and they're in fittings, and I understand how the fitting process works. But I would have loved to have seen the process of the choosing of the fabrics, going through them, her selecting the fabrics that worked for her, how her design process worked, how she created or how she directed her design team to create the look that she wanted. And I did feel that was missing from the program. We sort of went from her ambition, seeing this extraordinary clothing, seeing how successful she has become, how determined she is, seeing those incredible shows in Paris. But I felt, for me as a designer, I would have loved to have seen more time in her studio with her creative team and just seeing her creative process and understanding that more.
This is Victoria Beckham. This is as close as you get to it in the series. She's meeting one of her team to discuss changes made to a leather jacket in her collection.
These aren't mine, are they?
These ones are yours.
Amazing. Yeah.
So we've got your original ones from that we tried on the other day, and then these ones came in yesterday.
Oh, great.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. So much better on the cut there.
Can we go in here and I have a little look?
Yeah.
Amazing. Come through, guys. So nice.
Yeah, so amazing.
So nice.
The shoulder looks great. The collar's nice and strong.
I love it.
Yeah, even with the Alina jean, it looks fantastic.
It does look good with these jeans. Mm.
I'm fully conscious that the visuals of that might not necessarily transfer to radio. There you go. Do we see her work at all on the collection this? We obviously don't see what happens behind the scenes. So what element of that creation of the collection do we actually see?
Well, we really get to see the creation of the show. And for any designer, the show is sort of, it's what pushes us to our creative zenith, basically. Every aspect of the show has to be perfect. And for her, obviously, it's the clothing, it's the brand, it's who she is. And for Victoria, it's really important who's in the front row and impressing them. And I think that you will get this through the entire documentary. Victoria is constantly telling us how hard she works. And I understand that, because it is really hard work. But I think she wants to convince the world out there that it really is hard work, and she is working really hard, and she wants that to come across in the documentary, which it does come across. And you see the stress and the pressure coming up to the show, getting the fit right, getting the models right, the right look for the right girl, the right bag, the right shoe, every tiny detail, and it's really exciting. Your heart will be in your mouth as you're watching it, and you're seeing a live show come together in Paris, and with the minutes counting down, and things aren't working out, and things go wrong, and a model has an accident, and it's and the venue it suddenly turns into a sort of a Glastonbury festival in a rain downpour, and there are things you can't control, and you feel for her because image is so important to her, and she wanted that show to be perfect. So you're seeing all of the drama of that with her at the center of this sort of tornado of force that's spinning around her, but she's the one in the middle that's sort of holding it tight and being the grounding center of it.
Yeah, she'd well documented money problems along the way. Is that something they address here?
Yes, and my goodness, I mean, anyone in fashion knows to be in the world of fashion costs a lot of money. And especially when you're showing, runway shows cost a fortune. Advertising costs a fortune. Beautiful boutiques and stores cost a fortune. And Victoria wanted everything to be utterly perfect. And she did have the luxury of, she had her own money, and then her husband is a very, very, very wealthy man. And they were spending tens of millions of pounds on the collection. And believe it or not, she was losing money because she was spending money to make money and she wasn't making the money. There were parameters in fashion of where you can spend money and where you can't. But I think Victoria was blind to that. And she just wanted the best of everything always. And the people around her, nobody said no to her until it got to the point where she was asking David for an astronomical amount of money. And David's like, I don't think we can do this anymore. And she needed an investor. And I think that's where, that was a turning point for her, because this incredible investor, David Belhassen, came into her orbit. And David saw the potential. It's a beautiful story, and I won't spoil it for the listeners, but they can see it in the show, of how he came to trust Victoria and put money into the company, but then also to sit her down firmly and tell her, the way you're running the company is not how you run a fashion company. This is not professional. You can't do this. And there's examples of how Victoria was spending money that would put your hair standing on end. And Victoria never even realized that she shouldn't be doing this until someone actually said it to her. What are you doing here? This is ridiculous. This has to stop. And she listened to him and she stopped and he turned the company around.
So, Don, with the series and the show in Paris Fashion Week, do you think she herself will enjoy her success a little bit more now? Because she's always given out the impression that she doesn't really enjoy it.
Well, you know what? My heart breaks for her because I think she does enjoy it. She lives and breathes for it. But she's also living and breathing for the approval of others. And she has spent her entire career wanting the approval of others. When for me, even in the program, she comes to David and says, I'm doing this for you to make you proud. And he's like, he adores her. He's like, anything you do is fine by me. I adore you and I love you. But I think what I'm getting from it, it's deep down that little girl inside Victoria, that's the little girl that she's trying to impress. And she can't hear that little girl cheering for her. And it makes me really sad, actually, to get emotional that she can't pull Victoria Beckham inside her, telling her, Victoria, you've done really well. And she can't hear that voice. And it's really sad because Victoria is doing amazing and she should be so proud of herself.
You've watched all three episodes of the series, Don. What did you think of it as a series?
I think it's incredible, and I can relate to so much of it. And I see a lot of myself in her, because imposter syndrome can play such a huge role for so many creative people. People look to the world of fashion design and think all of the designers are incredibly confident, and we make decisions so easily and designs flow out of our heads, and it's this incredible universe of ideas, and it's all champagne and red carpet, it's so easy. And I think what Victoria shows here, it's not easy, even for someone like her who had unlimited money, unlimited funds. She had celebrity, she had celebrity friends. None of it came easy to her. At the end of the day, putting those dresses on the catwalk, beautiful dresses that the fashion press would appreciate and critically acclaim. I mean, she was British Designer of the Year, I think, in 2011. And here she has Anna Wintour sitting in the front row of her runway shows, who actually she can consider a friend. She's come so far, but that ghost of the imposter syndrome is still haunting her.
I've seen that a couple of times. Anna Wintour, who was then editor of Vogue, I think she's now titled Global Chief Content Officer and Artist Director at Condé Nast, which is a wonderful title. But she really does like Victoria Beckham and her work, doesn't she? She's the toughest nut to crack in the fashion world.
She is the toughest nut to crack, and she doesn't tolerate mediocrity, and she seeks excellence, and she seeks quality, and that's what she sees in Victoria. She sees excellence, she sees quality. The dresses are beautifully made, they're properly priced. When you see her runway shows, there's the research in fabrics, there's the research in silhouette, there's creativity, the shows are beautiful, and Anna respects and appreciates that. And I believe that this documentary was actually Anna's idea to help Victoria with the American market, because she's well known here in Europe, in England and in Europe. But in America, she's not as well known. And Anna felt that this documentary would be the perfect way to penetrate the American market for the American consumer to understand the Victoria Beckham brand, which is just not clothing, but now it's an incredibly successful beauty brand. Her cosmetic range is extraordinary. Her perfumes are exquisite. There's a whole world that's exploding here with so much potential that Anna sees. Victoria knows she has it. And I think together they're trying to make it bigger and better. And of course, obviously, with the help of her investors, this is going to be something extraordinary.
It's been great to talk to you from Ballyhig tonight, Don O'Neill, fashion designer. Thanks so much for joining us on Arena. Don O'Neill, thank you for that. The series is entitled Victoria Beckham. That's what it's called. It is available on Netflix from tomorrow. To be published in The New Yorker is a signal that you've made it as a writer. Founded in 1925 by Harold Ross, the magazine has published the writings and short stories of everyone from Truman Capote and Hannah Arendt to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie and Malcolm Gladwell. It's also published a huge number of Ireland's best writers, from Sally Rooney to Anne Enright, Claire Keegan to Colm Tobin. It's a lineage that goes back to Frank O'Connor and Maeve Brennan, Edna O'Brien, John McGahern, Mary Lavin and Brian Friel. It is quite the list. This month, the Abbey Theatre is hosting an evening dedicated to celebrating that relationship. On stage will be Anne Enright, Roddy Doyle and Colin Barrett, but also two New Yorker editors, Deborah Treisman and Cressida Leishan. I'm delighted that Cressida, the deputy fiction editor at The New Yorker, joins me now from New York. Cressida, what is a New Yorker story? And has that definition shifted and changed over the years?
Oh, hi, Rick. Thanks a lot for having me. I think that we would say there isn't really a New Yorker story as such, although the outside world always thinks there is a New Yorker story. But as far as a New Yorker story goes, it definitely has changed over time. In the early issues of the magazine, from kind of in the 1920s and 30s, the magazine tended to publish a lot of kind of short, funny, humorous sketches that were much more kind of, they were kind of funny and voice-driven and tended to be, they weren't really what we would think of a short story now. They would be what we would kind of probably publish as shouts and murmurs, or what the magazine used to call casuals. And I think it wasn't until kind of the later 30s on that a kind of longer, kind of more traditional short story started to be published by the magazine. And then in the 40s, that's when Frank O'Connor started publishing and Maeve Brennan, and you get a much kind of richer, more psychologically complex story. It feels as though the Irish writers were kind of quite important in the development of that story form for the magazine.
So tell me about that Frank O'Connor story, about the first one of his. Was that 1945?
Yes, 1945. News for the Church. It's kind of set partly in a confessional in a church in Ballygrogan, Cork, and the priest is kind of a little snotty, I guess, and a young woman comes in who wants to confess to basically having an amazing night of kind of carnal intercourse, to which the priest just almost wants to puncture her ebullience. So it's kind of funny and unexpected in an odd way, and more a much slyer story than you may initially expect when you start reading.
We have a clip of Frank O'Connor here talking about what makes a good short story.
I remember Yeats saying to me once, the only secret of a successful play is give them a surprise every 5 minutes. And then years later, I had a great old friend, wonderful old man, a tailor in West Cork, who was the greatest natural storyteller I think I've ever listened to in my life. I've sat listening to him for hours. A wonderful man, full of talent and beauty and expression. But he learned that I was in the same trade as himself. So he got some visitors to his house to read him a couple of my stories. He was bitterly disappointed. And he said, ah, Frank isn't too bad at all, you know, as a storyteller, but there aren't enough marvels in his stories. So you see, Yeats is surprised every 5 minutes. And the tailor's marvels mean that both of them are really thinking of an audience. They're thinking of impressing that audience. And the danger for the storyteller is to have an audience rather than one reader.
Frank ultimately went on to publish, if I have this right, 45 stories in the magazine. But even then, he's far from being the Irish writer with the most. That's William Trevor.
Yeah, that's true. William Trevor, I think, has in total 46 stories in the magazine. I mean, there's a chance our archives are wrong, but from what we could kind of count up, it was like 46 for Trevor. In a way, it was a lot easier to rack up bigger numbers earlier in the magazine's history when the magazine published a lot more fiction per issue. So it would publish like comic stories and serious stories, like maybe two or three or far more stories per issue. So some of the earlier Irish writers have a kind of much higher number of stories than the contemporary Irish writers that we publish. But those kind of contemporary Irish writers like Roddy Doyle and Anne Enright and Kevin Barry Say are still actually publishing a lot of stories compared to their, you know, fictional counterparts from all over the world.
The event is going to be about Irish voices in The New Yorker across the years. Let me talk to us a little bit about other Irish authors who've managed to be published in The New Yorker over the course of the last number of decades.
What's interesting, Frank O'Connor, of course, and what's interesting about him is he was already very established in his career when he started publishing in the magazine. So you get the sense he already knew kind of exactly what he could do with the story form, as, you know, that quote indicates, that he was just kind of a master of kind of understanding what a short story could do. And then Maeve Brennan is another Irish writer who published a lot of fiction in the magazine. And interestingly, like Frank O'Connor, she was like living in the States when she was publishing in the magazine. So she moved with her family when she was 17 to the US and then basically spent the rest of her life here. But all her fiction, I think, pretty much was set in Ireland. So felt as though she was very much exploring either her own childhood in Dublin in some autobiographical stories, or she had a series of stories which followed like two different couples, one Rose and Herbert Dearden, who have a kind of very unhappy marriage. And there were many stories that just kind of immerse you in the kind of day-to-day reality of this marriage in, I guess, a very kind of psychologically complex way. And then Benedict Keeley, Mary Lavin, Brian Ferial, Edna O'Brien, who also had a kind of huge number of stories in the magazine, they're all kind of writers who are appearing kind of frequently, first in the from kind of the 50s, 60s and 70s on, and then Trevor, who starts publishing in 1977. And then more recently, yes, Roddy Doyle, Anne Enright, Colm Torbien, Kevin Barry, Claire Keegan, Joseph O'Neill, Colin Barrett have all been just some of them. The kind of contemporary Irish writers whose stories we publish. And then with Sally Rooney, she's not really a short story writer per se, so it's slightly a it's not a cheap, but it's like republished excerpts from her novels, which kind of are cut down and edited to form kind of short stories that can stand on their own. So that you want the reader to have the experience of just encountering this as a story, not a novel excerpt.
I'm interested, for those writers who are writing in the 50s and 60s, and maybe you have an answer to this, how did they send their stories into the magazine at the time? Were they physically typed out, posted, or were they sent by telegram? Do you know how that process worked?
I think they were probably kind of physically typed out and posted. I mean, Maeve Brennan was actually a staff writer for the magazine, so she was kind of would often be in the office, so would probably deliver hers by hand. With Frank O'Connor, I think that they were posted, and then the editors in the magazine would kind of read them, circulate them to each other, discuss them, and then decide which stories to buy or which stories to reject.
Do you think there's a disproportionate amount of Irish authors published in The New Yorker compared to other countries the same size?
Yes, definitely. Yes, I think so. There are a lot of Irish writers in the magazine. I think there's just the Irish writers do have a real affinity for the short story and a very strong sense of kind of place and voice and the kind of social world that is being explored in these stories.
I'd like to take another piece here. This is William Trevor reading his story, Kathleen's Field. And this is recording is from the 92nd Street Y in New York in 1990.
I'm going to read you a story called Kathleen's Field. I'm reading it because it was first published in this city, in The New Yorker, and it seems apt to read it tonight. I'm after a field of land, sir. Haggerty's tone was modest to the bank agent, careful and cautious. I was wondering, sir. His voice trailed away when Mr. Enzo's head began to shake. He'd like to say yes, the bank agent assured him. He would say yes this very instant. Only what use would it be when head office wouldn't agree? They're bad times, Mr. Haggerty. It was a Monday morning in 1948. Leaning on the counter, his right hand still grasping the stick he'd used to drive three bullocks the 7 miles from his farm, Haggerty agreed that the times were as bad as ever he'd known them. He'd brought the bullocks in to see if he could get a price for them, but he hadn't been successful. All the way on his journey, he'd been thinking about the field old Lally had spent his lifetime carting the rocks out of. The widow the old man had left behind had sold the 19 acres on the other side of the hill, but the last of her fields was awkwardly placed for anyone except Haggerty. They both knew it would be convenient for him to have it.
And that's William Trevor, recorded in 1990. Cressida, maybe tell me a little bit about the editing process, because it's something writers talk about quite a lot. How much work do you do with an author?
It really varies from story to story and writer to writer, but it can be a lot of work. I think we still, in a way, function very similarly to how The New Yorker did in the past, in the, you know, 50s and 60s, when some of those earlier stories were being published, where there are four people in the fiction department and we all read the submissions that are coming in that we think we want to publish in the magazine, have a meeting, discuss them, and then one editor will edit the story. So you tend to always edit this. If a writer comes in through me, I'll always edit that writer going forward. Sometimes it can be quite major things to do with the structure of a story or where what a character is doing or feeling isn't really coming through properly, or you can't quite understand what the writer wants to do with it and whether they know what's happening and it's just not coming through in the story, or whether they don't actually quite know. And then other times it might just be as simple as clarifying smaller details, or we often have to cut for space, so we tend to kind of be trimming back a lot. And then it goes through rounds of copy editing and fact-checking and more copy editing and more copy editing. And so the writer can go through like maybe four or five sets of proofs from the story being accepted to being printed. I feel as sometimes we keep coming back at them with more queries.
Has anybody ever sent a story in that didn't need any changing or any polishing at all?
Probably not, no. But definitely writers have sent stories in that they don't believe need any editing or changing. And there can sometimes be a standoff between the writer and the magazine, especially on the kind of copy editing front. And, you know, occasionally the writer will win, And sometimes you kind of get to know which writers won't really want to take anything. And so even when we're considering the story, we know that we need to take it as it is or reject it. Whereas there are other writers, you know that there'll be a lot more give and take in the editorial process. So you can imagine a story being revised more substantially. So we tend to think about what the writer's like when it comes to kind of edits and revisions while we're discussing whether to buy a story.
What kind of Ireland do you think has emerged through the pages of Irish Stories in The New Yorker?
I think you can probably feel that it's an Ireland that's changed a lot. In the earlier stories, you know, from probably the 40s to the 80s or early 90s, you can still feel how central the church is to life in Ireland and how, you know, important kind of like Protestant Catholic divisions are and how these communities are kind of bound by an understanding of how to behave. And then the stories explore a lot of kind of behavior or feelings or thoughts that don't really conform to, you know, what accepted behavior should be. And you can just feel in the stories from the kind of 90s and 2000s that a lot of those precepts or, you know, have just been kind of swept away. And there's a much kind of freer, funnier sense of what it is to be Irish, like Colin Barrett or Kevin Barry, for example.
Can anybody send in a story to The New Yorker? Is that something that still happens? Do you have any tips for writers?
The big difference now is probably we used to have a big paper slush pile. Now we have a big electronic slush pile. And we have readers who come in kind of a couple of days a week and they make their way through the kind of electronic slush and pull out stories that seem interesting and pass them on to editors to have a look at. I mean, it's still really hard to make it out of the slush pile. So the advice would be to, one, to send what you think your kind of very best work is, to read the magazine and have a clear sense of what kind of fiction we do publish, and to just send in, you know, fiction that you think kind of you could see it kind of alongside other stories in the magazine.
It's been lovely to talk to you, Cressida Leishan from The New Yorker. Thanks so many for joining us on Arena. A Century of The New Yorker's Irish Writers with Anne Enright, Roddy Doyle and Colin Barrett, and The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman and Cressida Leishan in conversation with Belinda McKeown takes place at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin on Sunday, October 12th. Tickets and information on abbeytheatre.ie. Although, as far as I know, there are just a few tickets left. Now, just to mention as well that the podcast from The New Yorker has so many stories that you can listen to from Irish authors such as Claire Keegan and many others. If you're interested, you'll find it on the magazine's website, newyorker.com, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. That is it from this evening's Arena. Shanna Gorman produced. Leah Murphy was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Paul Murnau. Just before we get you to John Creedon, tomorrow night we are coming to you live from the Pavilion Theatre in Dúnlaoire with an event celebrating the publication of the poems of Seamus Heaney. Now, the event itself is sold out, unfortunately, but you'll be able to join us live here at 7 o'clock tomorrow night to hear the entire programme. That's it from me. See you tomorrow, and John Creedon is next.